Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. You've got part of the History family in the house tonight because it's Zach and Beth on presenting duties. Hello, Beth. How are you doing?
Hi, Zach. I'm good. It's starting to become a bit of a regular feature, us two, isn't it? How many of these have been in the last 2 weeks?
I'm losing count. But the one with Sarah Jane went down particularly well. It might have been all of the banter about, you know, fixations on unclad ankles. That's a whole story for another day. If you haven't listened to that, then go back and avail yourself. It's a revelation. But who are we talking to today? Because we're in a very, very different place. Although I kind of feel like I might just have something intelligent to say on this.
You might do, because it's sort of something that appeals to the both of us, really, I think. So we're joined today by James Nelson. So James is an author. He's written a book that we will be discussing today. He's also a qualified solicitor, and he joined the Army Legal Corps in 1982, where he rose to the rank of colonel, eventually retiring in 2015. And his book that he's discussing with us today, Military Operations from Kosovo to Kabul, which will be absolutely fascinating. So James, welcome to History Hack.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Cool. So let's start off at the start. It's always a good place to begin. So can you tell us the origins of your story? So obviously you served, as we said, in the Army Legal Corps. What made you want to serve and then focus upon military law?
Well, I kind of stumbled into the law by default, almost. First, I got sort of A-levels that seemed to suggest a law degree would be a good idea. And then having done a law degree, I thought it might make sense to go and finish the job off by getting qualified as a solicitor. And I spent about 12 months in private practice having qualified. And I thought, gosh, this is pretty boring, actually. I need to do something a bit more interesting. And I had spent some time in a gap year after I left school with the Gurkhas, which is kind of how my book begins. I'd enjoyed myself. I thought the army was a great way of life. And the Army Legal Corps seemed therefore like an obvious possibility to spice up my legal career a bit. So that's how it all began. In those days, the Army Legal Corps was very small. There were only about 35 legal officers serving. And they didn't really have a sophisticated recruiting program, because you don't really need one when you've got numbers as small as that. So I made contact and following my interview and all the rest of it, I was in. I didn't look back, really. I certainly don't regret packing up private practice. I'm sure it's great, floats for many people's boats, and you make a lot more money usually than you do in the army, but I had a very interesting career.
And so as part of that, you've described that you were what a sergeant at Sandhurst referred to as a three-week wonder. And I mean, I don't know that term. So what's meant by a three-week wonder? And then did you experience any stigma off the back of that compared to those who maybe had spent an extensive period of time at Sandhurst?
Well, a three-week wonder was their highly amusing term for those of us who passed out of that course, because it was a three-week course. Whereas the normal cadet course for mainstream military officers was, in those days, I not sure exactly, but something around about 9 months. And to these days, it's a year. But we were known as the three-week wonders because, amazingly, we were supposed to have picked up all that amount of knowledge in a mere 3 weeks. But it wasn't just the lawyers. It was known rather irreverently as the Vicars and Tarts course because you had professionally qualified cadets from all sorts of different professions. You had the doctors, the dentists, even the vets, and the lawyers and the padres, who were all thrown together to do this short course, because we didn't need to know all sorts of highly intricate detail about infantry tactics and weapon systems and that sort of thing, because we were going to be practicing in our respective professions in uniform. So it made sense to, sort of with an economy of scale, if you like, to put all the professionally qualified cadets in one course, which was quite entertaining because we had, I suppose there were about 45 of us on the course, ranging from fairly slightly overweight sort of consultants in their 40s who decided very late on in their medical career to join the army, some very warlike padres, which was quite surprising. And then there were us lawyers. There were six lawyers actually on my course, and a handful of vets. And that was the makeup of the course. And we were all 3 week wonders at the end of it. You asked about stigma or, you know, any sort of prejudice against us for having only completed such a short period. The answer is not really, because I think everybody realized the rationale that I've just explained for doing that short course, and provided that your doctor could stitch you up efficiently, or your lawyer could avoid you being stitched up, to put it another way, or your, you know, padre gave you all the pastoral advice and help that you needed when you needed it, they weren't really fussed that you didn't necessarily have all the other skills that an infantry officer might have, for example. They didn't really expect that. So I suppose there were one or two people who probably thought we were just a bloody nuisance and who needs a lawyer when you're trying to kill people. But generally speaking, there wasn't a problem.
I think there's a really interesting question that we're going to come on to about how your role changes and whether or not kind of that perception of, you know, why do I need a lawyer in a war zone actually kind of changes with time. Because certainly these days we kind of feel a bit more as though we reflect on these issues of legality and so on, that little bit more. But I think we'll get to that, because first I want to ask a very kind of nerdy legal question that comes completely from kind of me as a military law historian. And it's about how the military legal system that you had to deal with kind of operates. How does it work? What did you have to do day to day? And perhaps most interestingly within all of that is, what were the challenges that you found yourself dealing with and that ended up frustrating you?
Well, I'll start with the system, if you like. It's changed a bit, as everything does, since I started, in that the Army, Navy and the Air Force were all subject to different specific statutes which set out their disciplinary system. There was the Army Act and the Air Force Act, separate statutes, pretty much identical, actually, both 1955. And then there was something called the Naval Discipline Act, 1957, which was quite different from the Army and the Air Force, the Navy being so much older and so much more different, if you like, from the other two services. And the effect of those statutes on those serving within their respective services is that from the moment you sign up, you are subject to, in the Army, the Army Act. And that means that military jurisdiction applies to you at all times whilst you're serving, wherever you're serving in the world, which is a big difference from a civilian on his holidays in exotic parts, because generally speaking, the way the law works is that jurisdiction is geographic. So once you enter a particular country, you're subject to the law of that country and cease to be subject to the law of your own country. But a soldier carries the British law in the guise of the Army Act, as it was then, wherever he goes, as well as being subject to domestic jurisdiction. And that can lead to issues of double jeopardy, potentially. So in order to resolve that, when soldiers are sent overseas on duty, normally there's a treaty, or possibly even just a bilateral memorandum of understanding with the host nation to resolve any issues like that of double jeopardy, to avoid him being tried twice for the same offence. So a soldier in this country is subject to military discipline, which includes quite a number of offences, which are only offences that can be committed by soldiers. For example, being absent without leave. If you're late for work as a civil servant, you won't find yourself prosecuted for being absent without leave. But if you're late for work as a soldier, or you decide not to come to work at all, in which case your absence without leave becomes desertion, then you can be prosecuted for it. And there are lots of other offences, things like insubordination, for example, which apply to only to military personnel. The reasons for, or the rationale and the way historically that system has developed is, I suppose, twofold in particular. One is because soldiers expect to perform a sort of expeditionary role, if you like. They must expect to be dispatched to all sorts of far-flung places. Maybe less so these days, but of course, in the days of the British Empire, lots of soldiers spent virtually their entire career overseas. So if you didn't have a system like that exercising jurisdiction over them wherever they were sent, then you had potentially a huge gap in how they were regulated, how their conduct was controlled, and so on. And secondly, in order to enforce the sort of hierarchical structure of a military force, you need to have a form of jurisdiction, which means that if you rebel against that hierarchy, if you like, there will be consequences. You have to be able to rely on soldiers doing as they're told, effectively, even in very difficult and very frightening circumstances, because that's the only way they win battles. So that's how the military legal system has evolved. Now, as of, I'm trying to think of the date, it was probably about 15 years ago, there's a Tri-Service Discipline Act, which means that all three services are dealt with under the one statute, instead of there being separate Naval Discipline and Army Act and Air Force Act. And the way it's, the way the Army legal services and the Air Force and the Naval legal services all fit into that is that they're responsible for advising the military chain of command on how that law works, in the same way as a solicitor in private practice advises a client, or a solicitor in, perhaps a better comparison would be a solicitor in corporate practice, advises his firm, his directors or whatever, on how to conduct their business legally. So a big part of the military lawyer's job has always been advising on that military discipline system, which starts at a fairly low level with soldiers being punished by their commanding officer in what's called summary dealing, which is kind of the military equivalent of the magistrates, if you like, but moves up to the court-martial system, which is roughly equivalent to the Crown Court with its jury trials in civilian life, where soldiers are prosecuted for more serious offences. And in those cases, traditionally, the prosecutor would be a military lawyer, a member of the a member of the Army Legal Corps, or as it's now become, the Army Legal Service. But there are other areas of work which we had to undertake. And it, what is most in demand really depends on what's going on at the time. So when I joined, there wasn't anything in the way of a war. Well, it's a Cold War going on, which fortunately stayed cold. But in terms of combat operations, the only show in town when I joined, and it stayed that way for quite a few years, was Northern Ireland. And that actually was more or less my first posting. I joined in February, I think. By the time I finished Sandhurst, it was February 82. I did the course in February. I think I went to my first posting in April. And I was in Aldershot, and I thought, well, I joined the army to see the world, and all I've done is move about 30 miles west from where I was in London before. But in August, they sent me off to Northern Ireland, so it didn't take long. And the job there was partly a sort of fairly mundane business of helping soldiers out with personal legal issues, partly advising the military chain of command on a variety of stuff. There's all sorts of administrative law within the army, as there is outside. But the sort of theatre-specific role for young military lawyers was what they called a flying lawyer, which was advising soldiers who got involved in a firefight, say, with the IRA, injured or killed somebody. And because it was domestic law, it wasn't an armed conflict where the law of armed conflict kicks in. And because it wasn't a foreign jurisdiction, because it was part of the United Kingdom, of course, UK domestic law applied. So the police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, their default response in a case like that was to arrest the soldier, and he'd be treated as a suspect, sometimes a murder suspect. And a soldier, a British soldier in those days, couldn't just ring up the duty solicitor to come and hold his hand if he was in the middle of some dodgy part of Northern Ireland and in the middle of the night, because he wasn't going to get a lot of help and sympathy. So the army filled the gap by providing this flying lawyer service, which was much more exciting than my job in London had been, because I was jumping into helicopters at all times of day and night and flying off to strange places, sort of in heavily fortified police stations, and advising soldiers who'd just been involved in a shootout with terrorists. So that was quite challenging.
That really doesn't surprise me in terms of what you say there in terms of challenge. Listeners will be pleased to know that I will resist the temptation to start talking about, you know, military law from 200 years ago, because that's a very different kettle of fish. But it is interesting the way in which this feels like something that's designed to solve a problem that's unique to the army. And in that sense, I think fundamentally, military law hasn't changed. Did you find yourself kind of wishing that there were elements of the law that could change to enable you to do your job better?
When later on in my career, particularly when I was deployed on operations, which I talk about in my book, particularly Kosovo, it wasn't necessarily that I felt the law itself needed enormous change. It was that people needed to understand it and implement it a little bit more efficiently and a little bit more quickly, actually, to respond to the changing military situation on the ground. Because, for example, I talk about in my book rules of engagement, which a lawyer obviously has quite a big part in helping to draft them. And it's really no good if you've got a system which is so bureaucratic that getting the rules of engagement changed takes days, when you've got stuff going on the ground, which demands a change immediately, as a matter of life or death. So that would be a good example of how, yes, I think, you know, things needed improvement and probably still do need improvement. I think for junior officers who had a role to play in dealing with discipline within their unit, it was quite difficult to keep them up to date and properly trained and educated on what the law required, and mistakes happened too often as a result of that deficiency. Similarly with the police, military police, they try very hard to do a good job, but they don't have the day-to-day exposure to crime that civilian policemen do, and therefore, you know, the skill is not so easy to maintain. And that's obviously quite serious if the police get it wrong when they're purporting to arrest people, or interview them, or handle evidence, and things become contaminated, the case becomes seriously jeopardized and subsequently taken apart in court by a defense lawyer, because there's been a problem in the earlier stages of investigation because people really didn't have the expertise that they needed.
It's interesting hearing you talk about ROA, rules of engagement, ROE. And for folks, I'm interested in your take on a film that came out, which folks will probably kind of have seen elements of what you're talking about in. So Eye in the Sky came out. It was looking at kind of the morality behind drone strikes. I just wondered if you could just say a few words. Exactly, exactly. And there is this scene where she's having a discussion with a member of the legal department. And there's this friction going on because she's got this pressing need within the role of her character to be cleared to a different kind of set of rules, because she needs to be able to carry out a drone strike effectively. What was your sense watching that? Did you have any reactions where you looked at it and just thought, please, can we get real? Or did it feel as though it kind of tapped into something that you were dealing with?
It was certainly a lot more realistic than A Few Good Men, if you remember that movie about a court martial with Tom Cruise. It was a while ago since I watched the Rules of Engagement, the Iron Sky film, so I can't remember in great detail. But I seem to remember thinking at the time that it wasn't a bad, you know, it had obviously been fairly carefully researched. But yes, I mean, I suppose the one thing always to remember is that the legal advisor is just that. He's only an advisor. He doesn't make the decisions. It's up to the commander to make the decisions. And very often a senior commander will have a fairly junior legal advisor as the only show in town in terms of a legal assistance. And sometimes commander's experience rightly outweighs how he's being advised. Obviously, lawyers by training tend to be pretty cautious in the advice that they give. And when you're giving life or death advice, that's pretty important. We tended probably in the British Army to have a slightly more cautious approach than perhaps our American JAG Corps colleagues, who always used to talk about being a green light lawyer. In other words, you know, I want to tell my commander that he can do what it is that he wants to do. And I don't like saying, no, you shouldn't do that, or you mustn't do that. I think my experience, most of my colleagues will probably be slightly more cautious than that. I used to think being an amber light lawyer was probably about right. I remember one particular case in Afghanistan where it was a multinational headquarters that I worked in. And in fact, I was the only Brit in an office, a big office of about 8 American lawyers. But we all advised the US as well as British commanders on the bulk of the combat troops were American, of course, but we all gave advice. The issues were kind of multinational, if you like. A particular case I remember was somebody who was suspected of planting IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in other words, a sort of homemade anti-personnel mine. And they had a drone in the area that they wanted to use to take him out. But I thought the evidence of what he was doing was unclear and needed to be better before a decision was made. And they got very impatient and they said, well, we've only got fuel in this thing for another half an hour or whatever. And the guy will be gone if we don't get on with it. And I said, well, you still need to check more carefully before I would advise that you target him. And it turned out that he was actually planting onions. Fortunately, we managed to work that out in time before somebody actually pressed the fire button or the trigger or whatever you call it on a drone. But sometimes you get it wrong, of course. On that occasion, it was lucky that we did what we did. And there were quite a few occasions. There was another one where somebody had come up with some great weapon system which could effectively detonate, rather like a flail tank on the beaches of Normandy in 1944. This thing could, from the air, detonate IEDs for some distance on the ground. So it's a great mine clearance system. The trouble is, though, you're basically doing what you're doing blind. You're just pressing button, and anything within range that picks up that signal will go off. But you can't see the context. You can't see who's walking past at the time or what's driving over it at the time. And so to do that would amount to an indiscriminate use of force without any proper precautions. And so I said, no, you shouldn't do that. It sounds a great idea, but legally it's not. So going back to the film you were talking about, I thought it was not bad in illustrating that sort of issue.
Gosh, a couple of those situations could have gone very wrong there, couldn't it? As the title of your book suggests, obviously you were sent out to Kosovo to advise on legal matters to a British commander out there. Obviously, when joining NATO forces, that does come with some sort of promotion and movement and so on. Yeah. Had your duties changed with that move? What were you doing in Kosovo that maybe you hadn't done previously?
It was a massive change, actually, as it happened, because my previous job had been in a prosecuting office dealing purely with criminal issues, preparing cases for trial by court-martial, varying from the sort of fairly... or advising commanders on summary dealing. So from very minor stuff to fairly serious criminal matters. I ended up prosecuting with a colleague a murder on one occasion in Germany, which was committed by it was an army wife who murdered her husband, who was a sergeant of the Royal Engineers, because even civilians come under military jurisdiction in some circumstances overseas. So I was doing all that stuff, which is purely criminal law, really. And then I got posted almost by default to this NATO headquarters, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, where virtually none of the work was criminal law, but it all involved the law of armed conflict. So in other words, the legal issues that kick in when a war breaks out or is about to break out, or some form of armed conflict at a lower level even. And I hadn't really been involved in the law of armed conflict for some years. As I said, when I joined, the only sort of combat operation the British Army was involved in was Northern Ireland. Then over the years, for various reasons, we got involved in an awful lot more. And it was Bosnia, it was the first Gulf War, and then, as we know now, then there was the second Gulf War, and then there was Afghanistan. You know, we've got quite used to soldiers going off to places often hot and dusty, and fighting wars which we weren't used to before that. So suddenly the requirement for lawyers to be able to advise on law of armed conflict, as opposed to largely military discipline, had rocketed up. Anyway, so I arrived at headquarters of the ARC. My boss was a chap called General Mike Jackson, who was quite ferocious in his reputation. He was actually very charming, but he, as I said in my book, he didn't take prisoners. And it also happened, coincidentally, that I was promoted to half colonel at that time. And as a half colonel, you're expected to know your stuff. So I had this rather ferocious new boss. I had newly been promoted, so I was sort of slightly nervous of the responsibility that came with it. We also had quite a sophisticated IT system in the office, which again I wasn't used to. I was pretty Luddite when it came to, you know, how I did my work. So all this stuff had to be learned in quite a hurry. And then just for the icing on the cake, as opposed to spending my tour quietly going on exercise for 2 years and sort of playing at soldiers, this Kosovo operation kicked off. And there are various sort of legal steps which you expect to be taken before things get as extreme as that. The first is legally that there has to be a lawful justification for embarking on the operation. And really there are only two legal grounds on which you can go to war with another country. One is if you are acting in self-defense, and that's a fairly, it sounds simple, but actually that is a subject of a lot of debate itself, because the US, for example, have a very sort of liberal understanding of the term self-defense. We tend to have a slightly more restricted term understanding in the UK. But anyway, so it's either self-defense, or the other basis on which you can attack another country is if the UN Security Council says so in a resolution. Well, with Kosovo, neither of those applied, because nobody was threatened. No other country was threatened by the Serbs, who were molesting the Albanian Kosovars in Kosovo. So there was no self-defense issue there for NATO, and nor was there a Security Council resolution. The reason for that largely being that there are five permanent members of the Security Council, of which two are Russia and China, and neither Russia nor China were going to agree to such a resolution because they were chums with the Serbs, apart from anything else. So people used to come to my office and say, is this really going to happen? You know, it's sounding as if it's getting a bit serious and we're all sort of preparing to deploy and go to war. And I said, well, no, it can't happen because there's no lawful justification. Anyway, how wrong can you be? the politicians came up with a novel justification, which is called humanitarian intervention. Which I think morally was probably perfectly sound, but still legally, it had me scratching my head. And even to this day, when the law has evolved, that was 20 years ago, the law's evolved, you know, as it tends to over the years. But even to this day, the notion of humanitarian intervention being a legal ground for attacking another country, which is what NATO did with its air campaign, is, in my view, pretty dubious. So that was the first of those steps which I would have expected that didn't happen. However, at my level, you just have to get on with it and advise the commanders who are in your above you in the chain of command. So we went to Macedonia to be prepared to go into Kosovo once Mr. Milosevic, the president of Serbia, decided to throw in the towel, having been bombed, which NATO initially calculated would take 4 days. Then it took 78, I think, in the end. So he was sitting in Macedonia waiting for this to happen, so that we could then go into Kosovo and take control. One of the things that I expected then was that we would have our status in Macedonia, our legal status, clarified. And I mentioned earlier on a few minutes ago that normally the way that's done is that you have a treaty with your host country so that you can answer the question, which actually the boss asked me once, was what if a NATO soldier gets drunk and kills a Macedonian citizen when he's driving a military vehicle on duty? Well, that should be clear, because your treaty would deal with the question of jurisdiction in cases like that. But normally, if it's an on-duty offence, jurisdiction would fall with the country who sends that soldier to war. So if he was a British soldier, it would be British military jurisdiction, for example. If it's an off-duty offence and it's nothing to do with his military duty, the general principle would be that the host nation's domestic legal system would have jurisdiction. But in our case, we had no treaty, largely because the Foreign Office hadn't got around to signing what they needed to sign to bring the relevant treaty into force. So one of my jobs, which became, you know, I had to keep on at for weeks and weeks, literally on end, was badgering the Brits up the military chain of command and then out it to the Foreign Office to get this bloody thing signed off. It wasn't difficult. It was all there, so that our legal status could be, our soldiers' legal status could be clarified. And in the meantime, you had from time to time Macedonian policemen picking up soldiers, sometimes traffic offences, sometimes slightly more serious stuff, and saying, well, we don't know about any sort of agreement with your country. As far as we're concerned, you're in our country and we're going to deal with you. So that was a problem, which never really got terribly satisfactorily solved during my time. And then the issue of rules of engagement, which I've also talked about before. The whole purpose of rules of engagement is to ensure that when soldiers are opening fire, they're doing so lawfully and they're doing so in accordance with the political direction of their military operation, and they're able to act efficiently as a soldier. In other words, you know, complete the mission successfully. And different countries all have their own national rules of engagement. But when they join together in an alliance or a coalition like NATO, you need to have a uniform set of rules of engagement for all countries, so that the commander knows if he wants to rely on an American infantry battalion, or he wants to rely on an Italian engineer squadron, or he wants to rely on special forces from Belgium. They're all bound by the same rules of engagement, and they will all act predictably, if you like, and lawfully. But unfortunately, NATO were so frantically busy with the fast-moving Kosovo situation that they never actually got round to drafting a set of rules of engagement that covered us as a force in Macedonia. And even when we got into Kosovo, the rules of engagement were not as clear as they should have been, and not as properly or widely disseminated as they should have been, because soldiers on the ground need to know where they stand.
It's just an incredible headache from the sounds of things that you had to deal with. I mean, how do you even begin to start to offer legal advice in a situation where the law is so muddy? It's incredible. But I'm not entirely surprised that everything has this air of sort of flying by the seat of your pants either. It does sort of have that. That seems to quite often be the case in these things. Yourself do a remarkable job of kind of muddling through and finding a way to make it work. Can I And feel free to decline this question. Can I just ask about your homecoming after your time in Kosovo? What was it like kind of coming back and dealing with that change of pace?
Well, I wouldn't want to sort of exaggerate the nature of my business on operations. I mean, I wasn't in the front line. I was not somebody who was likely to be coming home suffering from severe PTSD, having seen horrific scenes of violence and mutilation and endured sort of daily terror myself, which a lot of soldiers genuinely you do have to endure even today. But having said that, obviously this was an operation which was sort of evolving day by day. It wasn't like a steady state operation in a force which had been sitting sort of on garrison duties for years on end, and you just slotted in and did your tour and came home again and kept things ticking over. It was a quite a rapidly evolving operation. There were times both in Macedonia before we moved into Kosovo, but and also once we got up there, where tend to be fairly anxious about what the next day was going to bring. So obviously returning home was a massive relief from all that, and living in the Balkans, it's in those days anyway, and I don't know how different it is today. It's fairly rough in places, and life is not as as valued as we're used to. I remember being very conscious of how having lived in some pretty grotty circumstances for several months, as I say, not quite knowing what was going to come next, to get home, to be relieved of all that sort of burden of trying to predict and deal with these legal issues, and also the just day-to-day keeping yourself fit and healthy and safe, and also running an office with various people you're also responsible for, trying to ensure that felt the same. Suddenly having all that lifted and moving from a very undeveloped part of sort of South Central Europe back to Germany with its hedges cut short back and sides, very civilized, very well organized, and in fact I moved back in the middle of the summer, so the weather was lovely, and suddenly I had a month's leave at the end of the tour of duty, and I could just be with my family and do normal things again. It was fabulous. It was absolutely wonderful. But certainly the experiences of the previous few months were very, very vivid. And I think probably always will be, because compared to Northern Ireland, which was very exciting because it was my first experience of the army, certainly in operations, even in Northern Ireland you were in pretty much your own country, it's part of the United Kingdom. My exposure to danger there was intermittent, but it was I was part of an operation that had been going on for years, and it was keeping the lid on things and hoping to gradually push back against the insurgency towards eventually a political solution, which everybody was sort of reasonably confident would one day come. And apart from the odd atrocity, from 1 week to the next, life was relatively predictable. It wasn't like that in Kosovo. Even in Afghanistan, it was much more like that. It was a much bigger operation. And as we've seen in recent months, potentially equally significant operation in terms of what happened to people in the end and number of people dying or whatever else. But nevertheless, I moved into a steady state office in Kabul, where which had been working in a particular way for many years and continued to work like that for many years afterwards. Kosovo was short, sharp, very vivid, very exciting, and quite worrying quite at times. So getting home was a great relief.
And you just mentioned there, obviously, you've given us some stories about the time that you have spent in Afghanistan. Obviously, we know that the withdrawal has happened in recent months, and we've all seen the images on the news of the withdrawal of the troops, which has been very hard to watch in some circumstances, to just see the absolute devastation and the suffering that is going on there at the moment. Compared with your then experiences, and I suppose reflecting on your experiences in Afghanistan, what are your thoughts on the current situation there at the moment?
I feel desperately sad about it, because I didn't get to see much of the country. I'd love to have seen a lot more of it. The impression I got was actually of people who lived a very, very unsophisticated life on the whole. I mean, it's a rural economy. This is part of the problem, and always has been. It's such a rugged place that it's always been impossible to govern, really, from Kabul. And the people are incredibly tough, I think. And they have so little. And they've lived for generations through strife. And I just think it's terribly sad that things are no better now. In fact, probably a lot worse than they were 20 years ago when that whole operation kicked off. And I mean, who am I to sort of moralise about the rights and wrongs? But if you remember that the rationale for the whole operation to begin with was that Bin Laden was being sheltered there, the Taliban refused to give him up, and the US decided that they would deal with it largely themselves, although of course it was a NATO operation right from the start, the ISAF operation. It was the first time in history that Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which is the mutual defense article, was invoked. Basically that an attack on one member of the coalition is an attack on all of them. And that was the legal basis for the original operation in 2001. But you know, now here we are, 21 years later, nearly, and we've left it in a shocking state. And I think it needn't have been like that at all. I mean, it's not as if we went through some very, very bloody periods, particularly in the Americans and the Brits in Helmand Province, but it hasn't actually been like that for some years now. And it didn't take that much commitment compared to what had gone before to kind of keep a lid on things, and probably with more patience to have achieved a much more satisfactory outcome. So I think it's absolutely shocking, and for all sorts of reasons, the losses and the money that's been expended by dozens of countries, including our own, in contributing to what people, I think, genuinely thought was going to be a better outcome, and the way the country has been just left to fend for itself yet again. I mean, they had 10 years of the Russians, they saw them off, and everybody thought, I suppose, hoped that the end of the ISAF operation would be more satisfactory, but I'm afraid we haven't done ourselves any favours, and we all know who the sort of who the most powerful nation involved were, and I think it's a great shame that others weren't able to perhaps step in when the US decided that they'd had enough. But unfortunately, there just isn't there's no other individual nation that could do it, and there isn't a sufficient will for a sort of coalition to take their place.
What happened in the end for you? What made you decide to leave the army? Because you've now retired, I believe.
Oh, well, I decided to leave the army because I reached the age of 60 and I had to leave the army, unfortunately. The armed forces is still an unusual organisation in that they're legally able to discriminate you against you on grounds of age. And so by the time you reach that particular ceiling, that's it. In fact, most people have to leave at the age of 55. The professionally qualified, like the lawyers and the doctors in particular, obviously you don't get to join the army in the first place until you're already qualified, which in my case was at the age of 25, whereas your colleagues in the infantry have been commissioned already for 4 or 5 years by then. So they let you serve on an extra 5 years as a lawyer so that you can maximize your pension earning service, so to make up for your loss of that in the early years of your career. So yeah, I mean, if I'd been able to carry on serving beyond that age, I'd have very happily done so. I enjoyed it. And I'm just very grateful they let me serve till 60 and I didn't have to get out at 55. Otherwise, I'd have to go and find another proper job. So that was why. Having said that, of course, I'm not really complaining. I mean, it is a young man's profession being a soldier, and if you've got sort of old farts like me hanging around indefinitely, then it reduces the pull through opportunity for younger people, you know, coming in at the bottom and as they must do.
And so, obviously, with your book, what do you hope that people will take away from your book, especially in terms of maybe legal practice in the armed forces, maybe something they hadn't known about? Like, it's a topic that military law specifically, I know a fair bit about military policing in my particular time period that I study, but military law is something that I wouldn't know much about. So do you hope that people will take away some new insights?
I just hope it will be interesting and potentially of interest as something to consider as a career for young lawyers, because as I said today, and I hope I conveyed in my book, I found it, you know, fascinating. It was very exciting. If you are by nature rather restless, as I am, it works really well because you're posted every 2 or 3 years. You don't have time to get bored. If you hate your boss, or he hates you, or she hates you, then you know that in 2 or 3 years' time you're going your separate ways, and you probably never clap eyes on each other again. So, you know, for all sorts of reasons, and it's a worthwhile business. I mean, I think the armed forces are truly fantastic people on the whole. That it only works so well in all three of our armed services because it is made up of really good, dedicated, hardworking people. And so they're great people to work with. They're great clients to have as a lawyer. You know, so I would commend it as a career for anybody who wants to be a lawyer to consider, as, you know, out of the mainstream. Even if you only do 10 years or something, you have a lot of fun, and then you can move sideways back into the civilian profession. It's sometimes been kind of in jeopardy because there are some people who say, well, actually, you know, a civilian could probably do this, a civilian lawyer can probably do this, and we might even get better people if we go to civilian practice. But there are, and I can understand why, for certain types of legal advice, people would say that. They might say, well, if you're advising on human rights or employment law, which military lawyers have to do nowadays, you know, why do you need to be in uniform? But there's a danger there for the whole profession of sort of being a military lawyer. But when it comes to operational law, that the commander needs to have somebody with him in the field who can't just say, well, I'm sorry, my contract says I go home now. He's actually got to be in the chain of command so that he turns up when he's bloody well told to turn up, and he's prepared and trained and, you know, and capable of dealing with operating in the field fairly close to, you know, where the nasty stuff's going on. So I think that's really the, why operational law is the way to go.
And also, literally 200 years ago, in around 1811, 1812, and apologies, listeners, yes, this is my research, but a guy called Charles Manners Sutton, who was the Judge Advocate General at the time, decided that employing civilian lawyers really wasn't working for the army and was responsible for this major shift of let's bring in officers with a little bit of legal knowledge and let's focus on professionalising them. So, you know, probably best not to go back on the mistakes of 200 years. James, this has been fascinating. Genuinely, I've loved it. I know our listeners will have loved it. Military operations from Kosovo to Kabul. We will put it in the History Hack bookstore, or folks can go directly to, I believe it was Pen and Sword who published this one, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so go directly to the Pen and Sword website, folks, or click the link in the description. Please don't go to Amazon for one very simple reason. Same old rant that I always have. Jeff Bezos will turn all of your money into rocket fuel, and James, poor guy, will not see a fraction of the royalties he would get if you went directly to the publisher. So please go buy it direct. But James, thank you so much for joining us. This has been genuinely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it too. Thanks for asking me.